Some replacement level dudes talking about their home team. Starting a Braves podcast was their daggum dream. They like Nick Markakis, even the long ball. One day they'll have more clout than Ken Rosenthal. Oh, you're listening to that Knockoma Nation podcast show. Oh, Knockoma Nation podcast show.
Heyo, it's another episode of the Knockoma Nation podcast show. I'm your host, Ken Hendricks, and that is not JT and not Josh. In fact, they're at the beach enjoying themselves. Josh couldn't find the mute button in yesterday's episode, so here we are. I've completely kicked him off the podcast for the rest of the week while he's at the beach. And instead, I have two of my favorite people. I have my father-in-law, who's been on the show with us before, Robbie Jones. Robbie, how are you doing today?
Doing good, Ken. Good. Great to be with you.
Good, good. And we have the athletic director at Tusculum University, who once threatened my life with a baseball bat. He is Robbie's brother, my uncle-in-law, Doug Jones. Doug, how you doing?
Doing great, Ken. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad you could come on. Robbie and Doug are lifelong baseball coaches, baseball fans, baseball fill in the blank. I think you guys have done it with baseball, probably. You've umpired, you've coached, you've done everything. You taught me how to play at a baseball camp when I was 8 years old before I knew any of your family. So, I've got a picture with Doug in a Gardner Webb uniform, I believe it is, behind me. And Doug looks like he's all of 22, if that.
That's probably true. Or younger.
Yeah, you might have been younger. I think you had like the little half mustache at the time, like the little, you were trying to grow it in, but it wasn't really, you weren't really sure if it was going to grow or not. It was kind of going on there.
Yeah, that's right. A sad time in my life. Yeah.
But I wanted to hang out with you guys today for a few minutes and talk some baseball and talk life in general and everything that's going on with you. And I'll start a little bit with you, Doug. Doug, just kind of tell people what have you done with baseball? Tell them a little bit about your baseball career. I know you're pretty renowned in the baseball world.
Well, yeah, thank you. I've been extremely blessed, Ken. I mean, I coached, of course, played at Gardner Webb for 4 years there in North Carolina, and then was an assistant there for 4 years. And that was a fun time. Had a chance to work with my brother, obviously, doing camps down there in Emmanuel, and had a chance to compete against him as an assistant coach when he was the head coach at Emmanuel. And then was extremely blessed, got the job here at Tusculum at a very young age, 26 years old, and very blessed and fortunate. Coached here for 20 years. And then I guess about 5 years ago now, decided to step off the field and step into the athletic director role, and then since vice president of athletics and university initiatives. And that second part of that title simply means whatever they ask me. So kind of did the dual role for 3 years and realized that was pretty much impossible. So for the last couple of years, just strictly been the vice president of athletics and university initiatives, and very fortunate to have some success with some great assistant coaches and great players. And so just, God's been good and been blessed to be a part of something special here and building something special here from kind of the ground up and rebuilding that process. So been a fun time and a different transition for me being off the field, but, kind of enjoyed being a part of, witnessing and getting to participate in all of the sports that we have here, which we have, we have 22.
That's crazy.
That keeps me extremely busy. So been an interesting journey, but been very fulfilling and rewarding as well.
That's awesome. Now, Robbie, Doug won't brag on himself, but he's won a lot of games as a coach, hasn't he? That's my understanding.
He really has. I was going to bring that up, Ken. He probably won't talk about himself too much, but I will. I'll brag on my little brother. He just had his number retired.
Oh, awesome.
This year.
I didn't know that.
You know, or I guess last season, they retired his number 9. That was quite fulfilling for our entire family.
Yeah.
To be able to watch that take place. And, you know, Doug's just an amazing job at Tusculum. I do remember the days of coaching, you know, against each other when he was an assistant coach at Gardner-Webb. And then we couldn't hardly stand to play against each other. I think we did it one time. we played in a tournament, Anderson University tournament in Anderson, South Carolina. We played. He beat me 4-1.
Oh.
And I swore up and down I would never play against him again.
Now, people don't need to understand. Those of you out there listening, you need to understand. I grew up in a family that we played games and stuff together, and it was competitive. You know, I mean, like we were, there was some competition to it. And then I married into the Jones family,
yeah.
And I found out that I had no idea what competition was. My wife will not play Scrabble with me anymore because I beat her 3 times. I think it was maybe 4, and she refused to play ever again. Doug and Robbie are, I think they've competed over just about everything at some point, whether it be golf or eating or fill in the blank. I think they probably competed over it at some point. Now, Robbie, Doug's, he's the baby, right?
He's 11 years younger than I am.
Okay.
So there was a time when, like on the golf course, then it just got to the point that I couldn't compete anymore. So that's not even fun. But listen, Ken, you don't realize this competition. I got to tell this story for your listeners. The competition started in the backyard with wiffle ball. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where it started. If I remember correctly, you know, we used to love to play, you know, wiffle ball in the backyard. And, I think I may have gone off to college and came back. Mm-hmm. And so let's go, you know, in the backyard. And I think Doug's probably, you know, probably about 10 or 11 or something like that. We're out there. And this is no lie. I could not get him out. And so I realized there's something special about him. And so because I hate to lose.
And Doug at the time figured, Robbie talks nicely about you now, Doug, but I'm sure there was something special about you at the time.
I got to finish the story. Let me finish the story.
Okay.
So I could not get him out. So I started beating him with a wiffle ball. I beat him to the point he quit. And when he walks out back into the house, I said, "Quitters lose, so I won." And that's part of our competitive story that we have with one another, that, you know, I just couldn't get him out. And so we've been competitive. Listen, it was basketball. We play in the backyard, and Doug was recruited as a basketball player as well. Really good basketball player. So, you know, it get pretty competitive out there, but, you know, all in all, there's no one more proud of what, you know, we've had the privilege to be a part of. And so with every accomplishment that Doug had, you know, our family has just totally been, you know, ecstatic with what he has accomplished. And now leading the entire athletic program at a university.
Yeah, I mean, Robbie, every time it happens, Robbie says, "I taught him everything he knows. I coached him in how to do it."
Well, you know, there's some other stories about playing, you know, football in the living room. I mean, we've done it all. But we had two great parents, you know. Our dad is still living. But we had great parents who took us everywhere, and our dad who taught us to love sports and coached all three of his sons. He was a great coach. And so when the opportunity came for me to start the program at Emmanuel College, I don't know if Doug wants to tell the story, but, you know, Emmanuel College, they did not have a field when I went to be the head coach.
Yeah.
And so I called Doug and said, "Hey, man, I need you to come down, give me some pointers." And I think he walked through the gate, and I won't probably use the verbiage he used, but he's like, "What in the world are you doing?" And we've had some good times. Except when he beats me.
Except when he beats you. Well, Doug, let me ask you, from your perspective, which one of you was the meaner coach, Robbie or you? Because I know Robbie's stories. We've heard some of his stories about losing his cool, and especially on umpires. But you have plenty of years and experience in that too. Who keeps their cool better?
Well, I would obviously say, I mean, he shared this story. It's great. I do remember that wiffle ball experience when I left the field, the backyard. I would say crying. win in that regard. And that 4-1 win was probably the most miserable win I've ever been associated with. You don't like to be a part of that. You know, to answer your question, I would probably say that, unfortunately, and this is I'm not bragging, but I probably keep my cool better, which is no compliment to him, but,
I would agree with that. He was a lot more cool.
Yeah, we're extremely competitive family. I think Robbie touched on this, being extremely blessed that, you know, we had parents that were unbelievable. It took us everywhere and dad coached us all. And, you know, I've been interviewed several times and people have asked me, you know, who's had the most influence, on your career. And without question, dad taught us, you know, dad wasn't going to be the one that was going to tell you about stance and what you need to do with your hands and how to stay inside the baseball and all those things. That wasn't what dad, was. Dad was, how do you play the game the right way?
Right.
And how do you respect the game?
Yeah.
And, so nobody has had a bigger influence on me than him. Secondly, was Robbie, without question. I mean, like you said, we're 11 years apart and how he supported me through high school and college and, yeah, I shared the story a lot about in college how sick I got one time, and he slept in a van.
I did.
to make sure that, you know, I had medicine and all the things. And all those memories, I'll never forget, you know, him and Perlene and Durant, who would, you know, Lynn's parents, who would come watch us play, in particular when we were Wingate and even at Garden Well when I played, and, you know, standing in the on-deck circle, and I remember we're in the ninth inning, and, you know, I come up, the game's tied, and there's a runner at first, two outs, and I'll never forget this. Robbie said, "Just end it." You know, and I hit a walk-off home run down the right field line.
He did.
And Tim Corbin at Vanderbilt was the coach of Presbyterian at that time.
Nice.
Doug Fagan, who was umpiring, who was partially blind.
See, Doug wouldn't say those things to their face, even though he cracked you up. Go ahead.
And I'm not too sure the ball wasn't foul, Ken, that I hit out. The area, but there was so many memories and the impact that my dad and Robbie had on my life and my career and what we. But yeah, I mean, I could remember those early days at Emmanuel. I thought he was, he obviously needed to be drug tested. For walking into that situation.
Yeah.
Never forget the camps. And you were involved. I remember that.
Yeah.
That's how old we are. And, And you made a good career choice, by the way. I'm not too sure you ever would have been a hitter. You know, working those pants in 95 and 100 degree, and we were doing double sessions, Robbie.
Yeah, we were.
Double sessions, and never been so exhausted in all my life. Just so many memories, so many great experiences, and what he accomplished. I think, you know, people talk about some of the success we had here and, you know, 700, whatever. You know, a reporter asked me, you know, which game is the most important win of your 700 and whatever? And my response to that was always, I never won a single game.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Our players won games.
Right.
Right? They won games. We had a philosophy. They bought into it and all that stuff. But what he accomplished as a coach with no resources and what he did there with that program with, you know, one scholarship, two scholarships, And what he was able to do there was absolutely amazing. And but more importantly, I think we would both agree, it's not about that. It's about the email I got this morning from a kid I coached 10 years ago.
Right.
Who sent me pictures of his family and his kids.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Let me just jump in. I think that's the greatest. People talk about the wins and the losses and some of the, you know, great games and classics games that we've all coached and been a part of. But the greatest joy for me now, Ken, is to look back on my former players and watching them. You know, I think I have three or four high school football coaches in the state of Georgia. And one in the state of North Carolina is a head coach at one of the largest high schools in North Carolina.
Yeah.
You know, Richmond County, Brian Teal. And I think you knew Brian.
Right. Yeah.
And to look and see where these young men are today, who are some in the ministry, which thrills my heart. Some are great, dads. Some are, you know, wonderful fathers, and to watch their, see their families and let me just share this story and I'll jump off. But here, I had a dad send me a Facebook message the other day and it said, 10 years ago, we took our son to Emmanuel College to meet Coach Jones. That day changed our entire family's life.
That's awesome.
Now, and it may have been more than 10. Now that I think about it, it could have been, it was probably 20 or plus years. I forget the number of years that he was there, but now his grandson's getting ready to go to college. And he said, I just hope my grandson has the same kind of opportunity that Coach Jones gave my son.
That's awesome.
And I'm, you know, that kind of, There's not a victory. There's not an award. There's not anything that we've ever got that compares to knowing that we influenced a young man's life help him be a great citizen, to help him to be a great husband, to help him be a great father. That's the reward that I think we got out of coaching.
Yeah. Yeah. Gotcha. To change gears a little bit, Doug, you know, talking about the culture of the game and some of the things that have been changing. I know we talked about this before. Robbie, when you were on the show with us before, you talked about some of your highlights of arguing with umpires and getting thrown out of games and that kind of stuff. But he did mention when he was on with us, Doug, that for you, you saw the very culture of the game change pretty drastically, especially over probably the last, 10, 12 years of the sport, where you went from arguing umpires to you don't do that kind of thing anymore, to the game, I'm sure, even at a small school like Tusculum. For those listeners that may not know, Tusculum's, your baseball facilities are some of the best baseball facilities in all of college, period. out of all colleges. And even you get in the multi-million dollar colleges, you guys are basically right up there near the top. Because and for those listeners that are familiar with Georgia Tech's campus, Tusculum is very similar. And actually, I think my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Doug, but you guys, the program there kind of patterned a lot of things after the Georgia Tech campus, I believe it was, or at least their baseball facilities and that kind of thing. So what's some of the culture changes you've seen since you've been coaching and now moving into the administrative role? What's some of the changes you've seen and how have they affected like the actual culture of the game?
Yeah, I mean, Ken, there's a lot of differences. I mean, I think if you go back to the early part of my career, you know, we weren't in the what I call the showcase era of baseball. And I think that's what's really changed. And I think there's some good and there's some bad of that. I think anytime you take a 9-year-old kid and you ask that kid to specialize in the sport of baseball, you run a lot of risks, right? There's going to be a ton of burnout. We kind of went through that with Kate from my oldest daughter and all the soccer that she played from 9 on. And so I think that was the biggest shift in the fact that, you know, it really became showcase oriented. Therefore, the high school experience was not as beneficial as it was when Robbie and I obviously played and how important that was to our lives. So I think that's the biggest the difference. And then dealing with showcase coaches and then, you know, going to Lake Point there in Georgia, which you're familiar with, Kent. And I can remember, you know, we spent on the recruiting side, we'd spend 7 straight days there, and I would watch roughly 50 to 60 games. We would start at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I'd walk back in the motel at 2:15 a.m. We'd get up and do it again, and you'd come back with 150 or 200 names, and then so I think the culture of how you recruited was much different when Robbie was coaching and part of my career. When I was coaching, and you had to be a part of that scene. Yeah. And I think that, we all deal with the parent involvement. You know, you've never met a parent that didn't think their kid was the best thing.
For sure.
Right? And so, you know, you had to deal with that kind of culture shift. And so what Showcase Baseball did, and like I said, there's a lot of good to it, but what it did was really emphasized the importance of me as a player. And it took away the aspect of how Robbie and I grew up.
Right.
In the motto of our program for all 20 years that I coached here, on the back of every T-shirt we had, it simply said, it's not about me.
Yeah.
Right.
So and now it's all about them, completely.
It's all about
they come, especially you know, if they're coming to a school like yours. I mean, to be honest, most kids go into a smaller college like that, they're going there to try to be all about them and stand out. They want to be the guy that gets the attention on a smaller school. At least that's what they think. You know, it doesn't always work out that way, but that's I think that's what a lot of those guys go into. Well, I saw a tweet today to give you an example. Kylie McDaniel, he used to work for the Braves. You guys may be familiar with him. He's a FanGraphs guy that does scouting prospect stuff. He posted a tweet about a 13-year-old who's going to be a draft prospect in 2025. There's video of him. He's 6'6", 225 pounds, and throws 86 to 89 miles an hour with strikes. He's 13. You know, like I saw a report last month that it was like a Pro Strikes or Pro – I don't remember the name of the company, but they had gone and scouted 9- and 10-year-olds and had scouting reports on 9- and 10-year-olds for colleges to review. You know,
wow,
it's so foreign to me because I grew up, you know, you played little league ball, you know, like you didn't, there was no travel ball. I mean, like maybe a few kids played travel ball, but for the most part, you hope to get like kids that were good made an all-star team and you went and represented like your North Region all-stars or something. If you were really good, you might go compete in state that way or something. Like now those kids, they play in the fall, they play in the spring, they play in the summer, they play year round just about. And I think you're exactly right, Doug. Like it's really changed the sport to all about me. How's that actually changed how you have to coach players?
Well, I think the biggest difference is, as we talk about when Robbie and I played, you know, it became a game when we played with the guy at second and nobody out and hit a ground ball to second, and you move the guy to third, everybody celebrated
right.
that.
Right.
Now they're pissed off.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Because I made the first
exactly.
out.
Exactly.
So this is what I learned as a coach in the latter part of my career, is that you could throw out the window that the kids that we were getting in the college level knew how to play the game the right way. So you had to start in the early part of my career, kids knew how to play the game a little bit.
Right.
The middle part, later part of my career, you and I told our staff this, we start at ground zero because they don't know how to run the bases.
Yeah.
They don't know how to find the baseball. The things that we taught you at Emmanuel Baseball Camp of hit the ground ball, find the baseball, make a banana turn, as we used to call it back in the day, hit the front corner of the bags to create a straight line. None of that was taught anymore. So it was, now we're at ground zero with an 18, 19-year-old kid who, as a 12-year-old, my dad taught me how to play the game.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Right. So that's completely out the window. So you're basically, if you did not start, the biggest mistake I would tell our staff is assume. If you assume that they know how to play the game, the biggest mistake
right.
that you can, and assume that they actually understand what's coming out of your mouth, because
yeah.
this is the natural, right? I'm going to shake my head.
Right.
Yes. But you don't make them verbalize back to what you meant. So that was the biggest difference in because of, and like I said, there's some positives to showcase baseball, but that was the biggest negative because it was self-promotion. How can I make my, I used to call it macho, macho man, beat on my chest, look at me.
Right.
Baseball.
Right, yeah.
That was the biggest culture shift.
You know, let me jump in here. I think that's one of the positives, Doug, of coaching even at the small college level. For me, I'll just speak for me, is that, you know, to take kids that, I think some of the things I enjoyed the most. I mean, I can remember a two-time All-American who played for me got cut by another university. Okay.
Yeah.
And so he came to us looking for a chance to play. They saw him as a second baseman. I thought he could run like the wind, and there. We were wasting his ability to play second.
Right, right.
So I made an outfielder out of him, and he became a two-time All-Conference and All-American. And so, but to take a player like that and to instill in him how to play the game the right way, mm-hmm. Was probably, and again, it's been, you know, 20 plus years since I coached, but it's, That's one of the, for me, the things I enjoyed the most, and I think Doug probably can agree with that, is you take these kids who are just looking, how do I showcase? And those are the players that, for me, got drafted.
Yeah, yeah.
The players who thought that they had it all together and they deserve all this and that, they never really got looked at. But it was the players who really came into my program and said, you know what? I want a chance.
Yeah.
I want to get better every day. And they put in the work and they put in the effort and they listen, to a little bit of what you had to say. And they went out there and exhibited that. And then those were the kids that the scouts would come along and say, you know what? That kid's got some ability. And I think, so the culture, in a sense, I think is changed that with the showcase baseball. And I saw it, you know, even before I left Georgia and moved to Virginia, is that, I mean, I don't know how many games they're playing now, Doug, but, you know, it was close to between, you know, 125 and 150 games a year that these kids were playing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm telling you, by the time they got to the high school or the college, a lot of them were burnt out.
Yeah.
A lot of them were like, I'm tired. My arm hurts. You know,
I hate the game. And, I'm tired of playing.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
They lost some of that enthusiasm for the game.
You know, what you guys call showcase baseball, we tend to look at the MLB product a lot more on the show just because that's what people talk about. We call it StatCast baseball. It's pretty much the same thing, and that is that now everybody's worried about their stat. They're worried about trying to put up home runs, trying to put up lift the ball. Nobody wants to hit a ground ball to second like Doug was talking about because – and what's crazy is people on Twitter and that kind of thing, they get mad at a player like Nick Markakis and think he's not a productive baseball player because he does those things. Because Nick Markakis has more doubles in the last, 10 years, I think, than any other baseball player that's actively playing. You get guys like that their stats are so hyper-focused now on being Josh Donaldson and lifting the ball and going out and getting it out front and trying to be a home run hitter that the uniqueness of players is disappearing. Like I read a stat today. Ricky Henderson stole 467 bases after breaking the all-time stolen base record. Do you know the current leader in active bases, in stolen bases, Robbie? You know how many he has?
I do not.
Rajay Davis has 415. He hasn't even hit the number that Ricky stole after he set the record. Like he's not even close to it. And that's a fundamental shift in the way we play baseball. Nobody steals bases anymore because statistically they say you're going to create an out and you're better off to wait and let somebody try to drive you in, supposedly, you know, or get a fly ball or and that doesn't compute to me who's watched baseball my whole life and says, yeah, you may be statistically better, but that's not how you play baseball. That's not baseball. That's something else. That's a robot playing a game. That's not baseball.
I like that. I like to ask Doug this question. Doug, how many 220 hitters would be in your lineup every day?
Yeah, Robbie and I joke about this several years ago. I mean, it's the way that people, and I call them, Ken, the so-called experts, right, that think they know the game, but they've never, had their livelihood.
Well, they're sitting in their mama's basement sipping on a juice box telling everybody else how to fix the game, you know.
Yeah. But I would tell our kids all the time, to answer your question, Robbie, none.
Right.
because... And I know you coach this way too. I mean, we talked about, what does productive mean?
Right.
And if you're a guy, it's a completely different animal, but you're right, Ken. I mean, Major League Baseball and Minor League Baseball, they're trying to teach kids to lift. And it's okay if they strike out 200 times a year.
Yeah.
And for me, those guys kept a chart. Those guys were, running the camera. Right. You have zero chance of being productive for me, and that's why we, and I know Robbie bought into this philosophy too. We were quality at bat guys, so we celebrated the guy that hit a ground ball second and nobody out, right?
That's
more productive. We celebrated the guy who could lay down a sacrifice bunt or push or drag and put pressure on defense. So, and that's why, Robbie and I are of the same mold here. That's why we celebrate guys like Cal Ripken Jr. We celebrate guys like Derek Jeter. We celebrate guys even though he's not in the Hall of Fame and he's got a lot of faults. But Pete Rose. Robbie can tell you at our house where we grew up, there was dents in the refrigerator box. I would slide head first into it. We played the game the right way. And we don't celebrate the right things anymore. And it's sometimes it's very difficult to watch, to be honest with you.
One of the things I will tell you, to kind of just piggyback on what Doug was talking about, I can remember probably my best team that I had. And a little bit of a story. I don't know if I've ever shared this with you, Ken, but, the kid who really made our team go was a walk-on. He started as a walk-on. And he had, his name was Matt Nesbitt. and he had one leg just a little bit shorter than the other. And I had gone to the school to recruit a shortstop. And the coach said to me, he said, "Would you consider a walk-on?" I said, "Yeah, let me meet him." And the kid walks up. That kid transformed our program because of his work ethic. Okay? Mm-hmm. And our best team, he drove in over about 40 runs, batting ninth for me on our best team. Wow. Because he knew how to get us back to the top of the order to get us, to win games. And so when you recognize, you know, the way kids seem to play the game today, it's all about, you know, self, recognition and all this accolades that they're looking for from coaches and from mom and dad. But it's the kids. And I, you know, we were, my dad was a Yankee fan and we were Yankee fans for a long time. And I always looked, I said, it's not the guys, the superstars that win World Series. It's the Scott Brosses. Yeah. It's the guys that execute at the right time, who'll get the hit at the right time.
Well, it's Derek Jeter. I mean, Derek Jeter, he was offensively pretty good, but defensively, his numbers aren't good at all as far as, like, when you look at the actual numbers. But he was, when it mattered, he was in the right place at the right time every time. You know, like, that's he was terrible when it didn't matter. But when it did matter, he was always right where he was supposed to be. You know, and that means
something. Well, it wins games. It wins championships.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Doug has, you know, several conference championships, conference tournaments. He's taken his team to the regionals many times. And when you watch those particular teams, yeah, we all need the superstar kid, and the superstar player and every, but it's also the kids who know how to get the job done when the game's on the line. And let me tell you, that comes from a mental aspect as much as a physical. Mm-hmm. They're mentally in tune with the game. They understand,
right,
the situation, and they step up. So that I totally agree with that and believe that.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting, I don't know if interesting is the right word, maybe it's sad, to me, is when you look at the game, you see this hyperpolarization of every player trying to fit the exact same mold. You see a lot of people trying to be Aaron Judge or Giancarlo Stanton and strike out a lot, but hit a lot of home runs and hit a lot of power because that's an impact player. And there are some freaks that can do that. I mean, Aaron Judge can be impactful and bat 220. He's one of the few guys that might can do that, you know. But that's not what every player should be shooting to do. Or, one, you watch a lot of boring baseball of people striking out constantly. And, two, you don't have anyone for those guys to drive in if nobody ever gets on base. But what's weird to me about that is guys like Chipper Jones, Barry Bonds, even Mark McGwire, you know, like a Bash Brother home run guy. Mark McGwire's career batting average was .267. Like, that's pretty doggone good. And that was considered low, but .267 was pretty fair, you know. Barry Bonds was .298. Chipper Jones was, what, 300 or right about it? And that's a complete player, not I'm just going to swing for the fences kind of guy. And in fact, the swing for the fences guys didn't play baseball very long. I mean, you had Adam Dunn was that guy, you know, and nobody wanted him. Like, he had a place, but he wasn't like you weren't going to build around Adam Dunn, you know. Like, I mean, you weren't going to, he was just a piece that you put on a team kind of thing. But now it feels like more and more they shove more and more players in that direction of, if you are not this five-tool phenom, the only place you have on the team is to be a home run guy, is the way it feels. It feels like that's what everybody wants. And I'm like, guys, like, you need some consistency. You need somebody they could just play.
Yeah, and I would often say to our guys, and let's be honest, right? There's a big difference in college baseball and Major League Baseball and what they're trying to accomplish. Sure. But there is no difference in how you teach kids to play the game the right way.
That's right.
So it doesn't matter. You know, if you have the ability to play at that level, you're going to get there. But I would often tell our guys this all. It's about putting pressure on the defense, right? So if, for a college player, if you're, you know, I was not a great college player. I was a decent college player. But I would often tell our guys as a freshman, hitting in the three hole, I struck out 9 times, right? And I played all year. And so there, it's trying to get people, there's no, it's about putting pressure.
Right.
So if I strike out 45 times, that's 45 times that I made nobody pick the baseball up, field properly, make a throw, and the other guy on the other end catch it. Right? So it, you know, yes, there is a big difference in what they're trying to do at the major league level, but there is no difference of how do you play the game the right way. And I think that's where the value is lost, because now we teach 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old kids launch angle.
Right.
We're talking about launch angle. And in our day, we're talking about, can you backspin the baseball, the difference in backspinning the baseball, and what, if you want to topspin it, go play tennis.
Right.
In this sport, you have to be able to backspin the baseball. And that's what does create carry. That does create driving the baseball. So it's not all that different, right? We call it something different, but backspin is backspin. Proper launch angle is going to have backspin.
Well, and the thing is, I think because we call it different things, it gets muddled and confused by some people into what we're even talking about. Like we've done some series on the podcast where we looked in depth at some of these terms that people use now for things like launch angle. And launch angle used to be called going to get the ball, hitting it out front, getting the ball, going to the ball rather than letting it travel way back. You know, if you watch Josh Donaldson swing, I think he's like the launch angle guru kind of guy. The reason is he hits the baseball like 10 inches in front of his body. He doesn't wait for the ball to get center of him. He's out front hitting the ball, and that in effect then creates lift because what gets translated to players, and especially younger players, is uppercut. Because that's what they see when they see him hit that ball. But Josh really isn't uppercutting at all. He's just hitting the ball out front, which is naturally where his swing is already picking up. And so it gets lift. And I'm not telling you guys anything you don't know. It's just one of those things of, I think sometimes the language just, we've tried to make it sound fancy and it's confused kids, and they end up with bad habits trying to do something that people aren't even telling them to do. Or their parents are telling them to do.
Well, it's a different game. I I'm going to give my age away, but you know, I grew up watching Mickey Mantle play, and Mantle would strike out some, but he would also hit. You know, there's seasons he hit 350, and hit 50 home runs. Hank Aaron, you know, I got a chance to see him hit. I think I shared this last time I was on. You know, I got to see him hit his 696th home run in person. And, you know, but he was a guy who had a great average. He was all.
Yeah, he batted 305 for his career. You know,
all around players. And I think, you know, I don't know what, and I guess, you know, some of the, you know, the thought is we're trying to create excitement for the fans and things like that. But for the purists, for those of us that are just, you know, love the game for the game itself, there's nothing better than watching kids and major leaguers as well to play the game the right way. And listen, it is fun. And I think I want the kids to have fun, but always respect the game and always respect your opponent and always understand that, it's a hard game. It's a hard, hard game, and it takes a lot of work that probably the average fan does not comprehend of the work that is required to get where these guys are. And that's why I totally respect the guys who just demonstrate consistency for me not just a week in and week out, but year in and year out. These guys are, you know, making it happen, and they're fun to watch.
Yeah.
And I think that's the excitement of really the game of baseball is watching guys over a very, very long period of time excel in their craft. And I would hope that, we're not burning kids out. You know, we talked about the showcase. I just hope we are not burning kids out too early in what we're seeing happen today.
Yeah. One thing that leads into some other things. The game of baseball at the major league level has changed significantly, and at the college level, of course, too. What do you think of, one, them trying to speed the game up? Because I'll admit, when I was a kid, a baseball game was about 2.5 hours. Now, a baseball game's 3 hours, 15 minutes plus. You know, so there's the game has stretched out a little bit. But when you look at that and you see Manfred doing things like 10th inning, trying to put a runner on second, when you see them trying to tamper with the baseball so there's more home runs, when you even see stuff like the new reliever rule where a reliever has to face three batters, what do you guys, as quote old school coaches, how do you feel about that, Doug, when you see something like that?
Not a big fan of the majority of that. Now, I do think there's some things you can do to speed up the game. One is, I'm personally kind of in favor of what's called the batter's box rule, right? Get in the box and let's go.
Right.
It almost seems like, how many selfie opportunities can I get, right? I got to adjust the bat glove 12 times. And,
shin guard, left elbow guard, 14, you know, take the helmet on and off, spit 14 times, and turn in a circle.
And this is what I would tell our players. If you foul a ball off your shin and fall to the ground, you never saw me leave the third base box, right? Because my response was stay inside the ball. If you can stay inside the ball, you're not going to foul off your shin. So, get up, learn how to hit. Right. So, I think there's some things like that you can do. If we start a guy at second base, it's glorified softball, right?
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. But what in the world?
That's not baseball. And I don't like the reliever rule because I think it completely changes the strategy of how we grew up coaching.
Managing.
I agree.
The matchup. Yep. Right. So I'm not a fan of that, but there are some things you can do. Have the fourth guy in the box and replay. We don't have to challenge it. He's going to buzz you and say, hey, you got it wrong. Boom, 3 seconds, we're ready to go.
Right.
As a purist and a traditionalist and old school guys, you said, I'm not a fan of that. But get them in the box and let's play baseball. And you can do some things like that.
Well, my number one thing is just teach pitchers to throw strikes.
Yeah.
It's not too crazy.
Seriously. Every batter's a full count. Every batter, it feels like. Yeah. Especially when you get into the relievers. Especially
pitchers would just attack the strike zone. And I think we are watching an era of baseball where pitchers are afraid.
Well, I mean, how many Braves games last year, Robbie? I know you watched the Braves a lot. How many pitchers were in 90 pitches in the fifth inning? A lot of times. I mean, Mike Foltynewicz can't get out of the fifth inning without throwing 90 pitches, you know? And I'm like, dude, you are a fastball strike thrower. Why are you at 90 pitches in the fifth inning? If anything, you should be out of the game because you gave up too many home runs, but you should not be at 90 pitches in the fifth inning. That makes no sense for a guy with your skill set.
For me, that was always the the big thing is watching. And again, I'm older than both of you guys, and you know, watching the Bob Gibson's pitch and the name you guys probably hardly knows, Mickey Lolich, and watching those guys just constantly pound the strike zone, and they were successful. They really were successful. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big thing is, and that comes back to coaching. What are we teaching these guys?
Yeah.
We're teaching them to nibble all the time. Then mm-hmm. they're not going to be, you know, very successful. And almost we've conditioned them probably even from showcase baseball. You know, you're only going to pitch 5 or 6 innings anyway. And so, you know, you got to.
Yeah.
You know, make sure you don't give up, you know, the home run and those kinds of things. I just believe if we, it comes back to teaching players to play the game the right way. And it's more than just their physical ability. It's teaching them how to think the game. What are you trying to accomplish? And I know Doug was great at that with his hitters and his players. Is they practice, and I know we tried to do this as well. We tried to practice every situation that our players would ever, you know, face so that they would react and not wonder what was going on. And I'm not sure that that's happening today. And I'm not on the field, but I just wonder if that's really what, if that's really being the mindset of the game today.
Yeah, I'd follow up with that. Just say we used to celebrate, right? That 12 pitch innings.
Yeah.
12 pitch innings. Yeah. Then, man, you did a great job. Eliminate the big innings.
Right.
More runs. You know, eliminate those types of things. And to Robbie's point, I always tell our staff and players this all the time, that if you encounter a situation that we have not covered in practice, we fail.
That's right.
That's our job. And so I agree with Robbie. I think, you know, the emphasis on that is gone away. And can we teach you to launch anyway? Can we teach you to do that?
Yeah. And showcase baseball also on the pitching side of things has emphasized strikeouts.
Yeah.
I mean, the only pitchers that move forward throw 95 miles an hour plus and strike everybody out. And there's evidence that shows throwing 95 plus is a good thing. Like, there's nothing wrong with throwing 95 plus, but if you can't put the ball over the plate, it does zero good, as Sean Newcomb. I mean, Sean Newcomb is one of the most skilled pitchers the Braves have, but he's scared to throw the ball over the plate because he's afraid he'll give up a home run, so he can't. Because of that, people don't bite on his good stuff because they don't think he's going to put it over the plate, you know? I think showcase baseball, like you were talking about, builds a lot of that in because you got guys, everybody's trying to be Chris Sale and strike out 300 guys. And meanwhile, Greg Maddux could have struck out 300 guys probably most years if he'd have cared about that. But he's like, I'd much rather just get you out on one pitch than throw you three. Like, that makes, why would I bother throwing three when I can get you out in one? You know?
That's right. That's exactly right. And those guys that when we start teaching 12-year-olds, how important the throw of the slider is, and it leads them to a well-known name that we know. It's called Tommy John.
Yeah, right. So right.
It's about teaching kids to do it the right way, and I think that's what Robbie said, and I think some of that's been lost a lot, unfortunately.
That's one of the things I love about watching Mike Soroka is I feel like he's a guy that knows how to get the out. That's what he's there for. He's trying to get the out. He's not just trying to get the strikeout. He's trying to get the out. And he'll do whatever it takes to do that. That was growing up, I was spoiled. I watched Tom Glavin. I watched Greg Maddux. I watched John Smoltz. And of those three, John Smoltz was the only one that really was a strikeout pitcher, at least in the traditional sense, like we think of it, you know. To be honest, Glavin and Maddux probably could have struck out a lot more batters. But, again, Leo Mazzoni's like, sitting over here making a whole career rocking, watching these guys. He's like, dude, why? I've heard Leo talk about it. He said, I would simply tell him, why are you trying to, don't worry about striking guys out. I don't care if you strike them out. I want an out. I want out of the inning with no runs. That's all I care about. That's the focus of the game. But again, when it's personal and it's all about my numbers, my stats, and and baseball rewards it. Like, the Cy Young winner is going to be the guy that struck out the most people, not the guy that won the most games, because now we teach that winning and a win stat doesn't matter. And I'm like, are you crazy? That's the whole point of the game. Like, I realize it's not always accurate. Sometimes your team didn't score you any runs, but if you won 20 games this year, your team probably had a good shot at making the playoffs if you're a 20-game winner. You know what I mean? Let's be honest. If your team has more than one, has at least one 20-game winner, then you were probably looking at a shot at the playoffs, you know? And I'm sure that rule's not 100%, but for the most part, now, what was it last year? I think the winningest player had, the winningest starter probably had 18 wins, 19 wins, because they don't go deep in games. And
Here's one thing I would say that maybe all your listeners and everybody that's coaching youth baseball and all this stuff, there's one key number to all this. It is 27. Right? You get 27 outs on the offensive side, and you get 27 outs on the defensive side. Right? It varies a little bit if you're at home, you're away. Right? But how can I get those? Right? And on the offensive side, how can I make the most of it? And we always coach to the fact that they get 27 outs, let's not give them 35.
Right.
Yeah, right.
So that is the key number of the game of baseball.
Right.
And how you can maximize that number the best is going to be the one that's the most successful.
And you guys, if you've never watched baseball with someone like Robbie, you don't know how stressful it can be to watch a man sit there and watch 6'6" Chad Sobotka, who's trying to throw the ball 103 miles an hour, to a batter that's batting 198 and hadn't had a hit in the last 6 weeks. And Robbie's sitting there screaming at the TV, throw a changeup down the middle. The guy can't hit. He can't hit a baseball. Stop walking him. Don't put him on first base for any freaking reason. Don't put the ball anywhere near outside the plate. Make him hit because he can't.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think that's one of the things that has changed for me and frustrated me I think the bulldog, you know, I think of Earl Hershiser. I mean, that was his nickname. He was the bulldog.
Yeah,
and he would just literally go after you. And he would, and Maddox was the same way. They would outthink you. One of the greatest treats I ever had is to sit at a University of Georgia baseball camp. And I apologize. I can't remember his name, but he played a couple of years with the Detroit Tigers, and he played a couple of years with Tampa. Anyways, and he would sit there and tell you what the next pitch was going to be. He understood the game that much. He said, I faced Maddox, I faced Glavin, and he said Glavin was tougher for me to hit. But he sat there, and I was blown away. But here's what it taught me. It taught me that the guys of that era, they didn't just play the game. They understood. They had a mentality about them. They understood the game, and they understood what pitchers were trying to do to them. They understood the ins and outs of the game. And I wonder, have we just gone to totally ability? Can you make a splash, or are these guys really playing the game the right way?
Yeah, and Ken, I'll just say this: in a lot of clinics and things that I did talk, and I was talking to 9 to 12 year old kids, or maybe 13, but my message was really to the parents. And they would, they want to talk about what kind of bat I should get, what kind of glove I could get. And I would always say this at the conclusion of the camp. I would say the most beneficial thing that you can get your son to put in a bat is a mirror. Because if you can teach them to look themselves in the mirror and say, I'm responsible.
Right.
For what I just did. Then you're really going to develop a young man, because the parents are the majority of the problem, right? It's the umpire's fault. The coach is an idiot. They don't know what they're doing. But if you can start to teach your children to look themselves in the mirror and say, I'm responsible for my actions. And that's the, if I were to say, what's the most valuable lesson that I ever learned as a kid is that my dad and my older brother taught me that you're responsible for your actions. And was it hard? Yeah. Were they hard on me? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But they made me who I was. I learned to take ownership and responsibility for my own actions. And I got away from what I call TOB, which is transfer of blame. Right. If you teach your kids to get away from transfer of blame, look themselves in the mirror, you got a chance to have a successful young man or a successful young woman.
Well, that's going to do it for part one of Nakahoma Nation interview with Robbie and Doug. Tune in tomorrow for the completion of the interview where we talk about the Redskins and we talk about this year's 60-game baseball season and lots of other stuff. It's a ton of fun. Tune in tomorrow, and we'll see you next time, Nakahoma Nation.
Thanks for listening to the nation's leading replacement-level podcast. Nakahoma Nation is brought to you by Nakahoma Nation patrons. To become a patron, visit patreon.com/Nakahoma Nation. For new episodes and content, visit NakahomaNation.com. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NakahomaNTN. Special thanks to research assistant Braves Auctions Guy and spiritual advisor John D. Howard. See you next week, knuckleheads.